Hey everyone, Alan here, creator and host of Script to Screen. I've always been a fan of podcasts, and when I was still in college, I always wanted to host one, but it wasn't that simple back then. Nowadays, the options are endless, but there's only one that can help you and your podcast reach listeners and grow with your vision. Anchor. Anchor is a one-stop shop for recording, hosting, and distributing your podcast. Best of all, it is 100% free and ridiculously easy to use. And now Anchor can match you with great sponsors who want to advertise on your podcast. That means you can get paid to podcast right away. In fact, that's exactly what I'm doing right now by reading this ad. Anchor has been Script to Screen's home since I first started the podcast, and I couldn't be happier. Not only is it simple for uploading episodes, but fans can also reach out to us by sending voice messages and be featured on the show. So if you've always wanted to start a podcast and make money doing it, go to anchor.fm/start. Again, that's anchor.fm/start to join me and the diverse community of podcasters already using Anchor. That's anchor.fm/start. Send me a link when you're done. I can't wait to hear your podcast.
And now, a brand new episode of Script to Screen Spotlight here on Radio Lebanon 96.2 FM, made to be heard.
And welcome to a brand new episode of Script to Screen Spotlight here on Radio Lebanon 96.2 FM. You are listening to us on this fantastic Friday afternoon at 3 p.m. I don't know why I did that accent, but there it is. It is exciting. The weekend is here, finally. But no weekend is the same unless you have a co-captain or a co-pilot to help guide you down that weekend. So join me in welcoming the solo to my Chewbacca. The one, the only Hot Solo.
Hello, hello, Alan. Hello, screeners. Happy Friday.
It is indeed.
It is. I love Fridays.
Oh, me too.
They're like the best part of the weekend because it's just the second before the weekend kicks off.
Yup.
Party, party, party.
It's that anticipation.
Yes, exactly.
It's that anticipation for the weekend to begin. And it's also as adults, it's our time to just have fun. Let loose.
Yeah, go.
Get jiggy with it.
Na, 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 na. It's a release our inner child, I think.
Yes, release our inner child. Although sometimes, that relates to, you know, us going and grabbing a drink. But, I mean, you didn't do that as a child. What you did as a child was, I don't know, go out and play.
I had drinks as a child. No,
really?
No.
That's exciting childhood.
Very interesting. I watched a lot of movies as a kid.
Me too.
That was like my favorite pastime, I think. That and playing with my action figures in my room and making up stories.
I loved action figures.
Yeah, my G.I. Joes and whatnot.
I didn't have G.I. Joes. I had a bunch of Mortal Kombat characters. I may have had one or two G.I. Joes, actually. But my favorite action figure was actually a character from the Disney animated show, Gargoyles.
Yeah?
Yeah. It was Brooklyn.
Okay.
But it was like an ice version of Brooklyn. So he had like, on his wings, he had like almost like icicles and all that stuff. He looked pretty badass.
Nice. No, I had Ninja Turtles. I had The Flash. I had Superman. I had Batman. Well,
I had a few DC superheroes.
I had G.I. Joes. I had these weird skeleton-like creatures. I had like a huge box and I would stay for hours like making stuff up.
Yeah.
It was a lot of fun.
Ooh, I had the Power Ranger action figures.
I think,
ones where you like clicked the center and their head flipped and then you got like the Power Ranger helmet on.
Yeah.
Those are really cool.
Yeah, they're awesome. They're awesome.
Go Power Rangers.
Dangers?
I don't know.
Dangers.
Danger, danger. You said you used to watch movies as a kid. Well, what are some of your favorite childhood movies?
A lot of movies like I used to watch and rewatch. There's definitely Mary Poppins.
Ooh, now, a spoonful of sugar.
Now, the weird thing is, even though now I forgot, I used to have it on VHS and it was in French.
Ooh.
So the songs were in French. So my first encounter with Marie Poppins was in français.
Was it like supercalifragilistique?
Something like that. But for some reason, I don't remember them in English, in French. I remember the songs in English.
Oh, okay, cool.
Because I watched it definitely later.
Yeah. What a classic. It's going to be interesting once Emily Blunt takes over.
Yeah, I'm very curious, actually. I think if someone could... And I'm saying,
It's her. There's nobody else that can pull this off.
It's Emily Blunt.
I think for a while they were considering Anne Hathaway, and I was like, ooh, no. I mean, I like her, but like, no.
But not Mary Poppins.
But Emily Blunt. I mean, she's a mom, which kind of helps. She has a very kind of Julie Andrews-ish vibe.
She's very classy.
Very classy. Very mom-like.
Yeah.
And I kind of, it works.
Very Mary Poppins-like.
I mean, it's interesting because the last thing we would have seen her in would have been A Quiet Place. And now she's A Spoonful of Sugar.
Very
different extremes.
Two extremes of the spectrum.
Very different extremes here. What
are the movies?
Oh, on my end, let's see. I mean, I was a big Disney kid growing up, so I'd have to say probably be a tie between Lion King and Aladdin.
Okay.
I think I've seen Aladdin like more than I can count. I mean, it's just such a classic Disney film. I'm so nervous about the live action remake.
I was a bit older when it came out, so that's why I don't consider it as a film I watched.
It came out in like what, 90? 95?
Probably.
94, 95, something like that. So I was around 4 or 5 at that point. No, because I was 13, 14. Yeah, but my sister was born in 91, so I was... Okay, so I was like 8 or 9.
Yeah.
I was like 8 or 9. So that's still me being a kid. I hadn't reached my teen year, you see.
Yeah, the wild teen years.
The wild teen years. But yeah, I mean, it's interesting when you go back and you watch these films when you've grown up, you kind of appreciate them on a different level when you do. And sometimes you're even disappointed by them because they were so glamorous when you were a kid, and then you notice you're like, oh,
I actually like that. What was wrong with me?
Yeah, I mean, not Aladdin or Lion King, because those are really good, but like other films. I know, actually, when I once... went back and started rewatching a few episodes of the Gargoyles animation series. Man, there were episodes that dealt with like gun control and all that stuff. And I was like, how was I watching this as a kid? This is so serious. Like, this is so dramatic. There was like mobs and like all that stuff. I'm like, wait, this is a kid's show. Like, what's going on? Why is this so serious?
I don't know. Maybe as a kid, you don't pay attention to that. You just pay attention to the characters.
Yeah, still. Yeah. Like, sheesh.
Things like echo and respond differently when you watch something at a different point in your life. So as a kid, they were like, okay, maybe guns. Do guns, don't do guns, whatever. But things definitely are different. At an older age.
For sure, which is why we love our Second Chance segment, which is coming to us later in this episode. So for our first spotlight in this episode, we're going to be talking about a much missed actor, comedian, spirit,
human being.
Yeah, exactly. The legendary, the amazing, the legendary Robin Williams. Boy, do we miss him.
Yeah.
Boy, do we miss him, really.
We miss him. Cinema misses him. Hollywood misses him.
Comedy misses him.
Yeah. Oh, big time, big time. I think the heart and soul of movies miss someone like Robin Williams.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was so impactful as that actor who gave so much heart in any performance he gave. Even in his most, if you want, twisted role what was it, 1 hour photo?
1 hour photo. Oh, he terrified me. I think that's the first time I ever looked at Robin Williams and went, you're creepy.
Yeah, with the blonde hair.
Yeah, oh my Lord almighty, that role was so electrifying.
But there's something. He had that aura. He had that je ne sais quoi.
Yes. He always had that certain je ne sais quoi. Yeah.
And Rob Williams was a genius to me.
Yeah.
Go on YouTube. I don't know if you've seen this. And there's an interview inside the actor's studio where he improvises for about 10 minutes.
Yeah, and it's nonstop.
With a pashmina.
Yeah.
A pink
non-stop.
Pashmina.
It's brilliant.
And it's hilarious.
It's so good.
He is incredible. The things he does with a simple scarf are fantastic. They're hilarious. Really. And you see the reaction of the students in the studio watching him, and they're in awe. And you can't but be in awe when you watch a guy like Robin Williams.
It's funny because inside the Actors Studio, I used to watch it religiously.
Yeah.
It's such a good... such a good show. I'm actually trying to look up the video now because I may want to try to play a little segment of it. If we can. Where is it? Here we go. Inside the Actor's Studio, improv. There we go. Explaining. Oh, there it is. I think here we go. I think this is it. Maybe.
Perhaps.
Perhaps. In the meantime, there's also another amazing video. Have you also seen the video of him actually acting out the genie in the sound booth?
Yes.
Ah, so good.
How many hours of the voice, what do you call it? Footage.
I mean, hours and hours on end.
Hours of footage. And what a lot of people, I think, don't know is that a lot of it was improvised.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
There was a script for the whole story of Aladdin, and there was the part of the genie.
Uh-huh.
And they gave Williams a lot of liberties into saying whatever he wants to say.
Oh, yeah. I think there was like 3 or 4 versions of every line that he delivered as they tried to figure out which one was the best. That fit the role the best.
And apparently the guy who kicks off the movie, the salesman, the Arab salesman with the camel, it turns out that it's Robin Williams. There was a lot of speculation for years as to who's voicing that character. And it turns out that Robin Williams does that at the beginning of the movie.
Oh, I always knew it was Robin Williams.
Yeah, in my mind it was him, but they don't credit him in the movies at the end as that character.
Oh, they don't?
No.
Oh,
they just
weird.
Yeah, just as genie. And with Aladdin specifically, Williams didn't do the second one. There was a
The Return of Jafar, it wasn't Williams. Yeah. And fans went ballistic.
Exactly. And then,
they brought him back for...
Return of the Thieves.
The King of Thieves.
Yeah, the King of Thieves.
I never understood why we needed Aladdin sequels, by the way.
Because, you know, Hollywood.
Yeah, but they're not that good. I mean, Return of the Jafar isn't bad.
But it's not Aladdin.
But it's, it's not Aladdin.
Yeah.
I actually enjoyed the animated TV show more than the sequels.
Yeah.
They had some pretty decent episodes of The Adventures of Aladdin, you know, like. But I mean, Robin Williams' performances aren't just limited to that. I mean, to creepy or
voice
acting. One of my favorite Robin Williams films would have to be Bicentennial Man.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I'm not the biggest fan.
Really?
Yeah.
I love that movie.
Tell me why. I'm actually curious.
Narrative, what it's actually discussing, the idea of life and what it means to be alive, what it means to be human as this android or robot or whatever he was, learns to become human and slowly becomes human. For me, it's a really interesting take on normally in cinema, you normally see humans wanting to become more machine or they wanting to become immortal or, superpowers or mutant powers or whatever. In Bicentennial Man, it's the absolute reverse. Mm-hmm. It's this immortal machine that actually wants mortality, that wants to be human, that wants to be alive, that wants to experience what it's like being human. I think one of the most, although it's a very minor scene, one of my favorite scenes in the movie is when Robin Williams' character first experiences a fart for the first time.
Yeah.
It's just, it's so, you know, minimal, but at the same time, it's so like, whoa, the human body can actually do this.
Mm-hmm.
for me, it's a massive, I mean, I cry in this movie all the time.
Okay, okay.
It's very interesting that you're not, I actually know a lot of people aren't fans of the film. It's
For me, like, I think William's most pivotal role, for me personally, was Dead Poets Society.
John Keating. For sure.
Because I've always wanted a teacher like that, and he, it's such a like really good story, it's such a good film, and it's well made, and William's, for the first time in a long time, is very serious and very refrained as a character. And that final scene in the end where all the boys stand up and they're like, Oh, Captain, my Captain.
Oh, man, my Lord, what a scene.
The tears just, they come and then they don't stop. And he looks at them and is like, thank you, boys, because... But I'm not going to spoil what happens in the movie, because if
you haven't seen Dead Poets Society at this point, like...
But go watch it. Like, seriously, it's such a beautiful film. And it'll make you want to seize the day, carpe diem.
That
he made that line ever so famous. I'm sure, like, thousands of people have tattoos because of that.
Yeah.
The carpe diem.
Yeah.
But it makes you want to attack the world, grab the world, and do amazing things. And again, he does it in such a subtle way. And he has these very small scenes where you see the Williams kind of humor.
Yeah.
Those kind of small jokes when he takes on specific voices because he loved doing voices. Mm-hmm. And it's freaking Williams, man.
Yeah. And speaking of very similar roles to, you know, like the older mentor-y kind of character, you cannot talk about Williams without talking about Good Will Hunting.
Yeah.
I think, wow. You know, literally, wow, what a performance, what a film, back when Damon and Affleck were not
Batman and Bourne.
Yeah, basically, Batfleck and Bourne, yeah. Actually. But Robin Williams's character in that film, that bench sequence, that big monologue that he gives Matt Damon's character in that film. You know, what do you know about loving a woman, or you know, like, what do you know about love? It's so iconic. And then you've got these minor Robin Williams films that really didn't catch on, but like What Dreams May Come is actually, I mean, visually, this film is a gorgeous film. And again, we're talking theme, we're talking heart, so much soul in this film.
And if you want to go back to our childhood a bit, there's Jumanji, there's Patch Adams, there's these cult Robin Williams classic
films. Good Morning Vietnam.
A bit more mature. But definitely a fantastic film. But he had these like so fun movies in the 90s, I guess.
And then they went and all they could do to pay homage to Robin Williams in the new Jumanji was simply etch his name on a tree branch.
Yeah.
Well done, Jumanji. Well done.
Bravo.
You can't, I mean, like, Jumanji is so good.
No, it is. By the way, going back to, I just want to say one last thing about Good Will Hunting.
Uh-huh.
Since we talked about farts, I mean, why not talk about that? There's this scene where he's talking to Damon about his wife farting in front of him for the first time.
That was improvised.
That was not part of the script, and he just improvised it.
And they're laughing
and they're cracking up, and you can see for a second Damon looking at someone, probably the director, Gus Van Sant. Should we continue or what do we do? And then they just continue.
See, lucky for them, Gus Van Sant was directing, because Gus Van Sant is actually like part of that Dogma movement. Yeah. So like he's very like chillaxed about that sort of thing. Again, another iconic role, and I think it's a role that literally describes who Robin Williams is and who will always be. Actually, you're talking about something else. I wasn't going to talk about. I mean, eventually, I was going to bring up Mrs. Doubtfire for sure. But for me, the role that literally it's the epitome of who Robin Williams is, the Pan.
Oh, Peter Pan.
And I mean...
My t-shirt. I'm wearing a Peter Pan
you
t-shirt.
You are wearing a Peter Pan t-shirt.
Ironically.
I mean, you couldn't have asked for a better person to play an adult.
A man-child.
Peter Pan.
A man...
Literally.
Yeah.
Yeah, literally. I mean...
Yeah.
He is the Pan.
He's the Pan. You are the Pan. What was it? The scene with Rufio and when he finally admits to him that you are the Pan.
You are the Pan.
Wow. Wow, what a scene.
Kills me every time.
What? And and Hook and Dustin Hoffman and Bob Hoskins and everyone. What
just a, like the stellar cast. But again, and you know, Spielberg, you know, he knows what he's doing.
Yeah, he does.
The film is so iconic. It's got a brilliant score, but it's also got, I think,
heart.
Williams. It's got Williams's heart, literally. Yes. You can see how much fun Robin Williams was having playing this role.
It's got twice the Williams, John and Robin.
Ooh. Well then.
Yes.
And then going back to
Mrs. Doubtfire.
Mrs. Doubtfire, which, I mean,
also, what a hilarious performance. What, and so many beautiful messages about family and about divorce and about how kids cope with it and is it their fault or isn't it and don't blame yourself. And of course, the performance is just hilarious.
Stellar.
He's so funny.
It's
dancing
stellar.
With that Hoover.
Oh,
playing football.
The dancing with the Hoover. I almost feel like this is it was their version of Risky Business.
Yes, it does feel like that.
Yeah, it's almost their version of Risky Business.
Yeah, and the that final scene where he's playing the male character and then he plays Mrs. Doubtfire in the restaurant, going from one place to another. And
I mean, it's brilliant,
magic.
brilliant movies, It's just sad that we live in a world now where there isn't Robin. I mean, he's still alive in the movies for us. You can always go back and see these films, but it's sad because now we won't get anything new from him. And, you know, I almost wish, and I almost know this for a fact, that if he was still around, I don't think, as much as I love and respect Will Smith, I highly doubt that Disney would have cast Will Smith.
I don't think
they would have brought him back, just like they brought back James Earl Jones to play Mufasa in The Lion King.
Yeah,
because I am certain that fans would have.
I would have been on board.
Yeah. I wouldn't have been on board if Williams wasn't involved. Had he been here today, you know, it's just sad. It's sad for me that we lost this amazing talent, this heart, this spirit. It's nuts.
You know, this very funny story about Williams and Spielberg while shooting Schindler's List, which was a very dark movie.
Yeah.
What Williams would do is would call Steven Spielberg and just tell
make him
jokes
laugh.
And make him laugh.
See, this kills me.
And it goes to show you the kind of human being he was. And that was reflected in his movies. You could see that in the characters he portrayed. He tried to give them heart. He didn't try. He gave them heart.
He gave them heart, man.
Effortlessly. And he's so generous. And I don't know if you've seen his stand-up. His stand-up is
the three of them.
My favorite is the first one, Live at the Met. It's one of the oldest
ones. Yeah, that was, yeah.
That I have a recording of that I listen to sometimes in my car. And it's just hilarious.
Yeah. It's a very crude Robin.
Yeah.
But I mean,
it's
hilarious.
Robin.
I love his Live on Broadway. His Live on Broadway, the HBO special was so good.
And even in those, he injects heart.
Oh, yeah. I mean, absolutely.
Which is the beauty of the guy.
And he's nonstop.
Yeah.
He doesn't stop.
Full of energy. My God.
It's 2 hours. I mean, the Live on Broadway is like 2 hours. Yeah. And the man doesn't even flinch.
Yeah.
It's, speaking of, oh, Captain, my Captain, and films being so inspirational, so magical, so full of heart, where have they gone?
I have no idea. Where the hell are they?
Where are they? I mean, really? Okay, let's put all these big blockbuster movies aside.
Yeah.
Okay, fine. We loved Avengers: Infinity War. We loved Mission Impossible: Fallout. Great. But where are the films that actually have good stories? Where are the films that are actually moving us? Where are the films that are bringing us to tears because of what they're trying to say, because of their soul, because of their heart? Where are they? Where have they gone?
I genuinely don't know. I think they're becoming rarer and rarer. Again, Hollywood is just focusing on the big money machine, making process of box office results, and let's not focus on good stories with heart. We've said heart 28 billion times.
Clearly, today's episode is brought to you by the word heart.
Heart, which you all need. no, but seriously, I cannot remember, like, in recent years, watching anything that had a huge emotional impact on me. You'll have a movie that pops up here and there once in a while.
Right.
I'm not saying they don't exist.
Right.
But I don't think they are as frequent as
they
maybe
used
90s
to
or 80s. Mm. Especially the 80s, I think, was an era where even an action film like Lethal Weapon had heart.
Yeah.
The relationship between Murtaugh and Riggs had heart. Two guys that don't want to be necessarily put together as police officers and end up together and forming kind of a brotherhood, a friendship, and you see that evolving in the movies.
Mm-hmm.
And you have so many, many examples like that. And nowadays, sadly, I see less and less of it. And I think the world honestly needs more movies like that.
Oh, we do. We so do.
We live in an era where we over-worry and we overthink, and movies are maybe too political nowadays, mm-hmm. and they just, you know, the whole process of going to movies was, at least for me, to go take a break from everything and dream a little and be mm-hmm. happy and have a huge smile on my face coming out of the movie. I'm not saying that the other genres shouldn't be made.
Right, right. But even then, with like drama films back in the 80s and the 90s, even those films, yes, they were dramatic, but they had hope.
Yes.
You know, they had a positive, even if it wasn't a happy ending, it was a hopeful ending. It was, yes, it's not over yet. Yes, there might be hope later down the line. And nowadays it's either, you know, it's too dark, it's too hopeless. I mean, you know, not to bring this back up again, because I mean, in every episode we have to at least talk about it one time, you know, the franchise. But I mean, look at how The Last Jedi kind of took on this character that was symbolically the character of hope, Luke, and stripped him off it completely.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when Rey sees Luke in the beginning, he is so cynical.
He's given up.
He's given up. So even the beacon of hope, a new hope, was stripped of it.
Yeah.
You know? And this is kind of the world that we, and now again with the news of the new Star Trek with Jean-Luc Picard, he might be stripped of his hope as well. It's really, is this where we are now? We need to see hopeless people? And hopeless futures. I mean, look at the dystopian films as well. Films like The Hunger Games and even the series like Handmaid's Tale. Look at how dark these futures are. And then you wonder why people are constantly complaining and they're constantly in a bad mood. It's because, well, you're putting us in a bad mood. You're showing us bleak futures. You're showing us futures where there is no hope, where people are enslaved. And
even if you look at sitcoms nowadays, they're quote-unquote darker.
Yeah, darker comedies. Yeah.
We used to have Friends. We grew up on shows like Friends, which was hilarious. For myself, I used to love Third Rock from the Sun.
Oh, loved it.
Just Shoot Me. These were like very funny, very light kind of sitcoms. And now sitcoms are, I don't know if you've seen It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia with Danny DeVito.
I have seen a few episodes of it.
It's funny, but it's
dark.
Gloomy.
It's dark. Gloomy. And then Louis C.K. had his comedy series as well. The hopeful heart is gone to a certain degree. It is gone. You know, you do have shows like This Is Us that are sort of kind of bringing it back. But again, even that is a little too dramatic sometimes. So I don't know why we've gone down this over dramatic, over sad, hopeless path. I don't know.
I wish I had the answer. I don't know, but the solution is make happier films, make more joyful series.
And again,
worry less.
We don't want it to be dumbed down.
Yes.
That's not what we're saying. We don't want it to be pure entertainment only. That's not what we're saying. Because when you have a film with heart, you're walking away with something.
Yes.
The film is touching you. And you said every once in a while, films will come up. For me, the finale of the new Planet of the Apes trilogy, War of the Planet of the Apes, I teared up at the end of that movie.
Yeah.
Because it was a satisfying, heart-filled mm-hmm. ending.
Yeah.
It was a conclusion that hits you at your mm-hmm. core. We spoke about this last week, Super 8.
Yes.
Which was, again, we called it the modern E.T., modern E.T.
Letting go.
And again, a father and son relationship that is being fixed, mm-hmm. if you will, through this over-the-top adventure that occurs. Mm. But again, look at the people that are kind of involved in this. Super 8 had Spielberg, who is, again, someone who is purely full of heart.
And you have JJ, which also kind of does have
Yeah, absolutely. And then the Planet of the Apes series had Matt Reeves, mm-hmm. who obviously has heart, mm-hmm. or else he wouldn't have been able to pull off these two films.
A fantastic trilogy.
Yeah. I mean, he didn't do the three of them.
He did the second two.
Right. Yeah. He did Dawn and War.
Yeah.
Rise of the Planet was directed by someone else. But it's just, it's weird for me that we've reached this.
I know I'm going to go back to Williams, but remember Patch Adams? It wasn't maybe one of the greatest films ever, but you can't leave the movie without having a sense of hope, without...
Forget the movie. Look at the poster.
Yeah, the big nose. But, you know, that final scene mm-hmm. where he's in court, mm-hmm. Possibly stripped of becoming a doctor, and all the kids come in with the big noses, and it's such a tearjerker scene, and then you see him with that other doctor played by Philip Seymour Hoffman, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. With that old lady who doesn't eat, and then they put a whole swimming pool of pasta and throw her in, and she starts to eat. I mean, it's a happy movie.
Yeah,
it gives you hope. It made me want to question what I was doing in university. I'm like, should I be a doctor? so these things that push you, I think for me are very important and decreasing. These days.
I mean, you went from films that, you know, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington and To Kill a Mockingbird. And then you had films like Philadelphia.
Yeah.
You had films, you know, A Field of Dreams. Mm-hmm. And now we've got, you know, Doom and Gloom.
Doom and Gloom.
Doom and Gloom.
Is that a movie?
No.
I know, but
just, you know.
But coming soon in theaters.
Coming soon. You know, it'll be a sequel to I mean, again, we mentioned Infinity War.
Yeah.
Look at the way this film ended.
Yeah.
I mean, you know what I mean?
Yeah, depression.
You know, like, evil wins, we're donezo, all the heroes are fading away, they've dissolved, Thanos wins. This is how we see the world now. We see the world as a world where evil wins and good loses. And this is a problem.
I'm okay with having such endings.
Yeah, yeah.
But there has to be a balance.
Right. Well, we know with four coming out, there's going, you know, good will prevail, you know. But still, I mean, I remember hearing people gasping in the movie theater at the end of Infinity War.
I remember people going, is that it? It finished? What happened?
Yeah, I heard two women in the back of me going, we just wasted 2 hours. This was ridiculous. How could they kill off Spider-Man?
Yeah.
Like this, you know, but again, mm-hmm. it reflects our time.
Yeah.
It reflects, you know, that people really think that we live in a time that is completely hopeless. Mm-hmm. At the end of The Last Jedi, there's only like 6 rebels left. You know what I mean? Like they send out a distress call and nobody answers. It's like, we've been abandoned.
That's
like,
it. Sayonara.
So here we are
at
the second chance segment of our show. Last time we had a second chance, you wanted to fight for Wakanda forever. And today is my turn.
Let me ask you a question.
Uh-huh.
Do you feel lucky, punk?
Is that supposed to be?
It's like a Clint Eastwood kind of reference.
I knew that, but I wasn't sure if that's what you thought I was going to be defending.
No,
today.
I know. I think I know what you, because you've been wanting to defend this.
I've been wanting to defend this for quite some time.
By the way, Ahmed, if you're listening to us, this one's for you, buddy.
Yep, it is. Okay, so what I brought into the second chance courtroom today is the one and only Man of Steel.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Okay.
I'm all ears.
Okie dokie.
Open minds.
So,
I'm listening.
Okay. So when I did do a rewatch a couple of weeks, actually, no, like last month,
yeah.
I did the rewatch. And I posted it on my social media. Hod's reaction was, "We're done. Don't talk to me anymore. We're done." And I was like, "No, no, you have to." And he's like, "Nope, I don't want to. I'm not talking to you about this right now. We're done." So I decided to force him to listen to my defense.
I'll listen.
On the show today. Okay, so here it is. And I'm going to be essentially summarizing my entire 1,050-word review, which is the longest review
ever
of Man of Steel here. And I'm going to kind of bring up some of the highlights of the review.
Okay.
As fast as I can, hopefully to make a good case for this film. First off, personally speaking, and I've read a lot of the Superman comic books. I was a big fan of Smallville, the TV series. I truly think, to a certain degree, that Zack Snyder's version of Clark Kent is the most accurate depiction of a real Clark Kent in cinema. And here is why. And I don't think we've ever seen Clark actually struggling with his identity in any medium. And maybe not to the extent that we see him struggle in Man of Steel. And it's not an identity of, am I Superman or am I Clark? But it's an identity of, who am I, period? You know, like, with all of these powers that I've been given, with all of this strength and, you know, power of flight and laser, you know, beams coming out of my eyes, who am I really to planet Earth and to the citizens of Earth? And, you know, we are kind of introduced to Clark at the beginning of Man of Steel as someone who is completely lost. You know, he's trying to figure out where he fits, how he fits. And it's, for me, it's the most human that we've ever seen Clark be. Although we did see him kind of humanized in Smallville, but this was a you know, high school Clark. It wasn't an older man Clark. And the path that he's put on in this film is an extremely emotional one, and one that has a lot of consequences and that deals with the consequences of choice. So you're dealing with a Clark Kent that's trying to understand himself as a Kryptonian and as the last Kryptonian, as far as he knows, as well as this man from Earth. Mm-hmm. It's very Messiah-esque of the character. And I know there's been a lot of, you know, symbolism and a lot of Superman tellings of him being kind of a Messiah-esque creature. And Snyder actually takes huge advantage of this in both this and in the sequel, which was Batman versus Superman. There's literally a shot in Batman, not to kind of sidetrack, but there's a shot in Batman versus Superman of this woman reaching up towards the heavens as Superman comes down literally from a beam of light. Yeah. I mean, you can't get more on the nose Messiah than that. And these are things that bothered me the first time around. And this time around, I thought they were genius. Because of humanity's constant need for a savior. So we kind of put Clark up on this pedestal without him getting a choice in the matter. Mm-hmm. He became the Superman without necessarily him choosing to. Does that make sense? Like, he was forced into this in a way. The way that this film is kind of structured narratively also has a lot of Christopher Nolan in this because of the timelines. There isn't like a chronology to it. We're jumping back and forth between Clark as a kid, and then Clark as a high school student, and then Clark a little older, maybe almost like college years. And those are very, for me, those are very interesting. When you do a rewatch, you kind of see where the narrative thread is going, even though it's not doing it in a linear way, if you will, because it is very non-linear, this film. And not to mention that the film's ending is essentially a moment that people thought they were going to see in the beginning of the film, because the film ends with him actually going to the Daily Planet. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, Lois introducing herself, although she already knows who he is, which is a point that a lot of people were bothered by. But for me, I was like, well, it's like wanting to see Uncle Ben in Spider-Man die a thousand times. Like, we know this. This was a new twist on it, you know? Cinematographically, I loved the film this time around a lot more. I think the harsh camera zooms and the very documentary style cinematography in the film was very interesting. There's a lot of, low angles. Okay. In the film, so we're always looking up in a lot of ways. There's constant low angles in the film, which I thought was a very interesting kind of play on, yes, you're looking up to Superman the whole time. Yes, it is CGI heavy. I'm gonna, you know, okay. Fine. It is CGI heavy, but if we're gonna be attacking Man of Steel for its CGI heaviness, then we can't not attack, you know, films like Black Panther and Infinity War for their CGI heaviness. It's a superhero film. You've said it where you've been like, well, it's a superhero film. You kind of need the CGI. You can't do it without. And I agree. You can't do it without. Now we get to the point that I feel like a lot of people hated in the film, which was the violence. Mm-hmm. Right. And I think this could be one of your issues as well within the film. Yeah. It's the destruction of Metropolis and Smallville and blah, blah, blah. So when I rewatched the film, I sort of understood where Zack Snyder was going with the violence. And it's literally the violence that's occurring around Superman is the violence that's actually occurring internally. So the rage that we see in Superman wanting to defend is literally someone who is trying, again, he's trying to figure out how he can save and protect while emotionally not being in control of himself. Mm-hmm. And this is something that any human being has experienced, where you lose control of your emotions, you make mistakes. And so this is a Superman that makes mistakes. And obviously the consequences of this are kind of discussed in Batman versus Superman. So instead of, Superman uttering something like, "I'm being torn apart," which is a line that we heard in a certain Star Wars episode 7 with Kylo. He says, "I'm being torn apart." Here, instead of Clark saying it, we're literally seeing it. Him tearing, being torn apart visually in the violence. And I think this is why the end of the film, although had a lot of criticism with him killing Zod and then screaming afterwards, for me this time around, it was like, well, okay. This is a person who's literally, he just killed for the first time. He's never killed before. We didn't see him kill before. This is the first time he's had to take destiny into his own hands. And it was either going to be Zod or that family. And so he had to make the hard decision of killing someone. And this is the ugliness of war. This is the ugliness of violence and terror and making difficult decisions of saving, you know, the one life versus the many. And we've never seen Superman being put in this decision, kind of in this corner before. So a lot of people hated it because it was too dark for Superman, because it's, you know, Lois and Clark adventures and zooming through the skies. And this was I feel like this is a Superman for the post 9/11 world. This is a much grittier and harsher and tougher Superman. To kind of go back really quickly and kind of mention the visualization of what Clark is fighting. There's a scene, and it's one of the flashbacks, and it's the moment that Jonathan Kent dies in the film. And it's literally, there's an argument between Clark and Jonathan, where Clark literally tells him, "Well, you're not my father. You can't control," something along those lines. And then a tornado hits. And then it's a storm. And then it's chaos. And with Clark literally having to sit by and watch his father die. Because his father notices that if Clark was to use his powers in that moment, there's an entire, village worth of people that are witnesses. So he tells him not to move. And Clark has to not move. And then witnesses his father dying. And this is, again, part of the buildup of Clark becoming the Clark Kent that we know. And I think a lot of people expected us to see the literal Christopher Reeve Clark Kent. But every hero has a beginning. And it was not necessarily an origin film, but it was an origination of, if you will, or a creation of Clark and the Man of Steel. And then on the other hand, you know, with Clark being the beacon of freedom and freedom of choice, you had the antagonist, which was General Zod, which is the epitome of what happens when your role is predetermined for you. He was bred to be a general. And so his entire structure is defend and kill and war. And so, you know, you had freedom of choice and being controlled, beating each other up. And so thematically, symbolically, I think in a lot of ways, I need to wrap it up. I think in a lot of ways, this is why I decided to give Man of Steel a second chance. And this is why the second chance hit me deeper than it did. And I understand it's a superhero film and maybe a lot of audience members don't want it to be this philosophical. But in literally a minute, almost minute 30, you have to respond.
I'm going to try to go as fast as I can. I'll compress this. To me, in the DC universe, you have Batman, you have Superman, the two big players. Batman was always the darker kind of character. Uh-huh. Superman was lighter.
Beacon of hope. Yeah.
We were talking about heart and hope throughout the episode. Uh-huh. I don't feel that this movie has a lot of heart and hope for me. Superman, I'm not comparing to Christopher Reeves or any other version of Superman, but there's more positiveness. There's more, I don't know, it's so much lighter. And I have too little time. I don't have enough time.
Yeah, I know, I'm sorry.
So much pressure.
I'm so sorry.
Look, here's what I'll do. I'll check it out again. But again, to me, Superman has to be something closer a la Captain America if you want to look at the Marvel Universe. It's light. You can be serious and light at the same time. The speech by Brando in the first Superman has so much hope. Sending my son to Earth.
Yeah.
And in Man of Steel, I didn't really see that. And I don't think I have any more time.
No, so you don't. We're literally going to be over. So we're not going to follow us on social media at Alan Mahana.
And at Dot Solo.
We'll see you again next week, guys.
Bye, guys. Bye.
Hi, I'm Alan.
And I am Han Solo.
And together we can rule the galaxy.
That might take too much time. Let's talk about films and TV instead.
That makes sense. Join us at 3 p.m. every Friday for Script to Screen Spotlight and Saturday for the Script to Screen News Hour.
We'll be discussing all the latest news from the film and TV industry.
And we'll also enchant you with some of the greatest songs and soundtracks out there. Script to Screen, only on Radio Lebanon 96.2 FM, made to be heard.